Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
New U.S. sanctions on Iran took effect today, 6 months after President Trump pulled the U.S. out of the international nuclear deal.
The sanctions target Iran's shipping, financial, and energy sectors, all key to the country's already struggling economy.
The bombs, which the FBI referred to as improvised explosive devices, were sent to the FBI's bomb laboratory in Quantico, Virginia.
We're in Mexico again tonight as thousands of migrants try to find a faster way to the U.S. border. The White House says it's now getting help from the Mexican government.
Breaking news out of Pittsburgh. The man accused in the shooting at the synagogue in Pittsburgh is pleading not guilty, and he also wants a jury trial. You can see he's facing a 44 count. So
in the final seconds before the Boeing 737 MAX crashed into the water, it was traveling at more than 500 kilometers an hour. All 189 people on board were killed.
You've now entered the House of Mystery.
Crime, conspiracy, history, and science.
With your hosts, Al Warren, Mike Brown,
Julie Sav, Michael Butterfield,
Dr. Joseph Usinski, and Michael Hawley.
Heard on KCAA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Quiet, numbskulls, I'm broadcasting.
You're back in the House of Mystery, and I'm Al Warren sitting at the controls, and our commentator is David North Martino.
I am here. Thanks, Al.
Yeah, kind of.
Kind of here.
Well, here we go. So now today we are talking with an author, and we're from Pen and Sword Books, which we've done quite a few of their authors. Do some great books. So we are going to talk about the real Sherlock Holmes, and we're going to talk about the author and all sorts of things about this. So Angela Buckley, thank you for being here.
Thank you for inviting me. It's fantastic to be on the show.
Angela, so how did you get into writing about, you know, history and this sort of this kind of a story like Sherlock Holmes?
Well, I was on a career break from teaching. I used to teach languages, in fact, and I was quite bored, so I started doing my own family history, and it soon became very apparent that my ancestors, who mostly were in the UK, not all, were very poor, and many of them had actually broken the law. And so they committed all kinds of crimes, theft, swearing, which was a crime back then, brawling, you know, drunkenness. And my Italian family, who were in Manchester, because I'm from Manchester, my Italian family in Manchester, I discovered Detective Caminada because he was part of the Italian community.
Wow. Lucky you didn't end up in Australia, right? I mean...
Surprising that we didn't end up in Australia.
And swearing, I'd be in jail for my whole life. My... so that is, it's pretty interesting to go back in your family history, isn't it? It's kind of, I think a lot of us don't realize what our ancestors had to live through.
Absolutely. It was a huge eye-opener for me. And in fact, my first experience, which wasn't crime-related, was to go to a workhouse graveyard, not far actually here in the south of England, and to see the, there's a gravestone to unmarked graves, essentially. They put a plaque up to find that, you know, three generations of my family who were paupers and died in the workhouse, you know, were buried in that long neglected graveyard. And, you know, for me, born, you know, in the later half of the 20th century with so many opportunities, it's huge. It's truly humbling, I think.
Yeah, pretty amazing, you know, and I, well, watching that series, the Murder, Mystery and Families, you know, where they're trying to go back and see if their ancestors were convicted fairly. And I can't believe how many of them, they just buried them all in the same hole, kind of.
Well, yes, exactly. And, you know, whilst on the one hand, some crime adds some colour and drama to your family tree, it does make you think about their experiences very much so. You know, it's a sobering journey, but it's too late to change the past. But I think I've found the more that I've done this is that I also like to honour their voices and bring their voices back to life, particularly poor people and working class people. And I think, you know, that's what I can do now is to, when I'm talking about crime and not necessarily crime with my own family, because now I investigate all kinds of crime. For me, I think it's quite important to bring the victim stories back to life as well as the perpetrators.
So when you're doing a lot of your crime coverage, how do you choose what cases you want to sort of research?
That's a really interesting question. I find that they find me. So often it'll be about location. So there'll be a location that will grab my attention. For example, it might be somewhere where I've lived. So I've done quite a lot around my childhood home in Manchester. There was a famous shooting of a police officer and again, a miscarriage of justice there. So that's what drew my attention. Here in Reading, we had a serial killer in 1896, who was a baby farmer. It's probably one of the UK's most prolific serial killers, but she was a woman, so her story's been partly lost. So it tends to be location and character. I do research. I'm doing a PhD at the moment in detective history. And when I go through the court records to have a look to see what the detectives did, because that's essentially the focus of my studies, something will grab my attention and then I want to study those further. So it might be a small detail or an interesting relationship or an unusual crime. And then once it's grabbed my attention, I usually find that when I start investigating, then I have to see it through to its conclusion.
I just wonder, how hard is it to investigate some of the older crimes, the ones that were done a long time ago, like in the 1800s? Is it in the UK, is it difficult?
No, it's probably easier here. From 1837 onwards, through the Victorian period, it's much easier here because the court records, there are millions of court records that were kept, and not all have survived. So we're quite fortunate here. We can go to the National Archives, which is just up the road from me in London, and you can have free access to all the court records. And, you know, often you just get a massive box with lots of parchment, sort of rolled parchment, kind of scroll, not exactly scrolls, but sort of folded paper that are quite dirty. They've obviously been, you know, somewhere else for most of, you know, most of the last century. And often you're the first person that's looked in them, you know, for decades. And that for me is the most exciting thing. You know, you start off with a big box of paper and then you rustle through and you think, wow, I'm uncovering things here that nobody's ever written about, nobody's researched. It is truly memorable. And if it's something connected to your own family, it's even better. So sometimes, even though you're supposed to be quiet, sometimes you want to stand up and go, hey, just look what I found, you know. Like if I found photographs of dead bodies that you find in there. Evidence, I found evidence from crimes for 150 years ago, buried in these boxes in small envelopes, you know, like pieces of cloth with bloodstains on that nobody else has ever found.
No, it's crazy. I come across that. And some of the pictures the cops have taken of the criminal and stuff, I'm surprised at what they used to do, how they used to treat people. Mm. Crazy. So what's the biggest sort of surprise since you've been searching crime that you've come across?
I think there are always lots of surprises. I think in terms of the research, I think it's quite special the first time, which sounds slightly peculiar, this is the first time you come across crime scene photos. I think for me, the biggest surprise is how, and it's something that's a feature of my PhD, is how skilled the Victorian detectives were, despite their lack of training and despite their working class backgrounds, how skilled they were in crime investigation and how that process developed, I think is really surprising. And I hope to be able to publish that at some point. But there are lots of surprises there in how they connect the dots, you know, how they deduct things. And of course, this is real life, you know, it isn't fiction. So that never ceases to amaze me, I think, is the brilliance of individual police detectives who are operating without any forensic science, without any real formal knowledge. Yet they still, now you could argue that they don't always get the right result, and that's certainly true. But the process, I think, for me is always surprising and fascinating.
Yeah, I think it is too. It's pretty amazing. So now this book here, you've got the Real Sherlock Holmes. And so maybe explain the premise of this.
So Detective Jerome Caminada was basically a boy from the slums originally. So he was born in Manchester in 1844, right at the heart of the slums, where my own ancestors lived. And in fact, on my English ancestry, my three times great grandfather had a brothel on Detective Caminada's beat. But he rose from absolute poverty. So he was a child of immigrant parents. He had a basic education. He joined the police force and he rose from poverty to become one of the city's most celebrated detectives in the history of the city, not just back then. In the 19th century, he was a household name, but he's got forgotten over the century since. And so I wanted to bring his story back to life. And his casebook, he wrote his memoirs. It really does have all the hallmarks of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's writing. He was an extraordinary character. And I've not found any other character since I've developed my research in this area. I've not found anyone quite so unique as Jerome Caminada. So I wanted to bring his story back to life. And so I've been researched his exploits, because that's what they really are, exploits and adventures, to retell his story. And that's what the book is about.
So what did you find? Like, what did you, when you do something like that, I'm sure there's a lot of things in this case that you didn't expect to find.
I didn't expect to find such a variety. So he was responsible for catching something like 1,200 criminals single-handedly when he was a detective in the city. And I think, you know, it's been really interesting to find out more about all his cases. So you've got everybody sort of in there, from quack doctors and forgers and racecourse thieves and fake air hunters and of course, murderers. And I think for me, it's the variety. I mean, and I'm always amazed by the ingenuity of criminals as well as the detectives. And the variety and the range of crimes that were taking place in the late 19th century or the second half of the 19th century in places like Manchester, which was, you know, was a crime capital of England at the time, that never ceases to amaze me. And then, of course, Detective Caminada's sense of deduction and how he works things out, and how he brings his, you know, his criminals to justice effectively.
How did he go about solving a case? Did he have a specific method that you found?
He tended to, like most detectives of that era, he tended to rely on instinct to a certain extent. So he kind of instinctively knew when a crime wasn't a crime, when it was a crime, and when it wasn't, so he could kind of differentiate. And then he had an encyclopedic memory, it would seem. So he knew the criminal fraternity in Manchester extremely well, and in other parts of the country. So he had... I mean, they used to go into prisons to memorize, you know, offenders' faces, you know, before they had photography or before photography became so common. And he used to do that. So he was able to, he had a great wealth of knowledge of individual people and perpetrators. And he learned about lots of different crimes. So he learned about chemical poisoning and he learned all about the law. And he could just make these extraordinary connections that were outside the box, I think, compared to other detectives. And that's what he would rely on. I mean, he relied on eyewitness statements. documents, like all the police did. He also had a network of informants that he used to. He was a very devout Catholic, and there's a beautiful church that still exists in Manchester called the Hidden Gem. It's called St. Mary's, and it's right in the centre of the city, as still is today, and it's surrounded by kind of tall buildings, and it was in the past. And Caminar is a beautiful white marble church. It's a stunning interior. And Caminar used to go in there and meet his informants on the back pew. And he used to pretend that he was in prayer. And in fact, he was just eliciting information. So he had all these kind of skills. He was able to disguise himself, and he did regularly. So it was a combination. And he was fearless, and he was determined. You know, he would go to to the last degree to catch, to catch his man, as they said back in the day, but to catch his perpetrator.
One thing I noticed, when they caught someone like a murderer or something and they tried them, it seemed like they were just, if they were found guilty, they were hung like in a couple of months or even sooner.
I mean, that's true. So they did carry out executions very swiftly, usually within a month, usually. It is a bit of a fallacy to think that that there were so many hangings here. In fact, there weren't. Execution wasn't that common. They gave out the death penalty regularly, but usually it was commuted to life imprisonment. So here in Reading, we've got a Victorian prison, and I've done some research into its history. And over its 100 and sort of roughly 50-year period, they only carried out about 23 executions, which is probably, fairly indicative of the rest of the country. So there really were only, most cities, I mean, outside of London, of course. So Manchester, for example, probably wouldn't have more than one or two executions a year, although it does seem as though, they were always executing people. But it was very, you're absolutely right. It was very fast. It was, you were taken from this place and off you go. And it could be, the following weekend. Unless you could be spared by a pardon or somebody would intervene. There was always this desperate rush to get the authorities to intervene and then, have it reinvestigated. But you had to be pretty quick.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say there's no 15 years of appeals.
No, not at all. No.
Well, it's crazy. So another thing is, I guess the lifestyle, I guess you really kind of had to, delve into how people lived in the 1800s and because it was so much different and the things that people faced. And that has to really come across in the book as well.
Yes, there's lots of background information in the book, and certainly, the poverty. So at this time in Manchester, actually, poverty was still endemic, and particularly in certain communities. So the Irish community really suffered in the city. They used to live in these awful cellar dwellings where the river would rise, and it would be damp all the time. Also, the people who worked in the mills. I mean, there's one quite poignant chapter where Detective Caminada chases quack doctors, and they're, fake doctors. And it really was because the health of the people at the time was so poor that they couldn't afford to obviously get care from a real doctor, because you had to pay for everything. So they turned to quack doctors who used to sell them, lotions and potions to improve their health. And of course it didn't. It did the opposite. And then they used to have to start, stealing in order to kind of fund their habit. But the pitiful physical appearance of some of the victims, is really moving. The people who worked in the factories, they'd all go deaf because of the noise of the textile mills. They weren't fed properly. They'd be pale. And of course, disease was rife in the city. Cholera, typhus, diphtheria would just rush through the communities, claiming thousands of lives. So this is really the backdrop of life in Manchester at the time, and of course of the book. The life expectancy at the time of Caminada's early career in the 1870s was about 18 years for a working class adult. So it's not very long, really, is it?
Just like Sherlock Holmes, Detective Caminada also had a nemesis, very much like Moriarty. Is that correct?
He did have a nemesis. I mean, he wasn't. I mean, he was very clever. He wasn't quite sophisticated as Professor, Moriarty. But he was about the same age as Caminada, and he was a blacksmith by trade. But by night, he was also a very successful burglar and a lock, you know, a lock picker. He used to go for safes. He used to pick safes, locks of safes in warehouses and shops. And he met Caminada for the first time at the beginning of Caminada's career when he was a police constable. And Horridge, he was called Bob Horridge. Bob, it's not quite the right name really for such a Machiavellian character, but he was called Bob, Robert Horridge. And he stole a watch, and PC Caminada, as he was then, was responsible for catching him. And because it was the third time that Horridge had been served a conviction, he was then sent down for 7 years stretch, because he had like a three strike system back then. And so he vowed that he would get even with Caminada. And throughout the next 20 years, they kind of played cat and mouse. And Horridge went down another two times for burglary. And then it all came to the head in 1887, when Horridge was discovered breaking into a shoe shop. Again, not very glamorous, in the middle of the night. And he shot two police officers. He didn't kill them. It wasn't Caminada. And then the chief constable knew that the only man to be able to run Horridge to the ground was Detective Caminada. Detective Caminada went into disguise. He consulted his informants, and he tracked Horridge to Liverpool. So not so glamorous, obviously, as Switzerland. But he recognised Horridge from a distance by the way that he walked. And he snuck up behind him, basically. And both were armed. Caminada and Horridge were both armed. And he managed to grab hold of Horridge before he could put his hand into his pocket to get his firearm. And he said something like, you know, one move, literally one move, and you'll get the contents of this, as he held the gun to his head. And he brought him in. And Horridge then served a life sentence. So it was kind of the climax of that relationship, if you like. And interestingly, you know, they were actually both quite similar in their background. So, but one chose to, you know, go for the law, and the other one chose to break the law.
Hmm. So a lot of people, poisoning was a big thing back then too, wasn't it?
Yes. Again, it wasn't quite so common as portrayed, but yes, there were arsenic poisoning, certainly towards in the 1880s, well, all the way through the second half of the 19th century. Caminada didn't come across too many poisoners. He did come across a woman who almost poisoned herself because she was hoodwinked by a suitor. He was a sort of a con man. There were lots of con artists in Victorian England. And so she was tempted to take something that she didn't take enough, fortunately. And it was the Metropolitan Police, actually. And they managed to save her. And they referred it to Caminada because she was from Manchester. But yes, poisoning was a problem because, of course, without the forensics, it was very difficult to detect. We have obviously had the arsenic test from 1838. But even then, it was pretty difficult to say conclusively whether somebody had been poisoned.
I was going to say, too, and this is the time of, the Jack the Ripper and all that sort of thing. Were there a lot of serial killers around other than Jack the Ripper, like in Manchester? Did they have that problem, too?
No, I don't think serial killers were that common. I mean, you have the baby farmers that I referenced earlier who you could say were serial killers, and they were women who took in children for fostering, which was... There were no legal practices at the time. You could sell your children, so they would buy children to adopt them, and they would either allow them to starve to death. And in fact, this particular case, she did strangle them, and that she would be a serial killer because she had hundreds of children, and she was only convicted on one. But in terms of, you know, more regular sort of homicide, no, not really. I don't think most, from my experience of looking into the archives and looking very closely at court records, I would say that most homicides were domestic abuse, domestic violence cases.
Mm-hmm. And you were saying it's quite poor. So the city was very poor. Like, there's a lot of people that had no money and they had to do things to get by.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to BOLLandBranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
So, you know, prostitution, I guess, stealing things and things like that. How did the police treat people that were in that kind of position?
Actually, with quite a lot of compassion, I would say, and not just Caminada. He was very generous, actually. He often tried to rehabilitate people. He knew people very well. He understood their challenges. Now, it was in England, certainly in the 19th century, there was a deliberate policy of employing police officers who were working class. And this was because they were strong and resilient and physical. But actually what it meant was is that the police constables understood where people were coming from because they were from the same, you know, the same background. And so many of them were very compassionate. There's another police officer that I researched who worked close to where I grew up myself in Manchester. And he opened a soup kitchen for the poor people that he encountered in his police work, which went on. You know, he fed hundreds of thousands of children and starving families through the winters, which went on right the way through his 50-year career. So there was a great deal of compassion. And there was a bit of a camaraderie as well, which perhaps sometimes is romanticised, but actually it was true. It was based on reality where they would, you know, let people off, or they would say, oh, just, you know, try and behave yourself a bit better, or I'll take you home, or that kind of thing. So no, there was a lot more compassion, I think, back then.
What kind of a home life did Jerome have? Was it was he married? Did he have kids?
Well, yes. I mean, he had lots of personal experience, lots of personal tragedies in his own life. Firstly, when in his childhood, so his father died when he was three, and one of his brothers, and then they were thrown into poverty because his mother was illiterate and she worked in a textiles factory. And so they had to move to a really poor part, an even poorer part of town. And there were further deaths in the family. And there's a lot of evidence in the death certificates of his siblings to suggest that the family were blighted by syphilis. And this was really common, obviously, in Victorian England with no antibiotics. It just, again, spread through human contact. So when Caminada married in 1881, he was quite old by then, by Victorian standards. He was in his late 30s. He married Amelia Wainhouse, who was the daughter of another textiles worker. And they set up home together. But their first three children also, they died of congenital heart disease, which again is possibly linked with the syphilis, the infection. So they had a really tough time. They did have two more children later on who did live long and healthy lives. And Caminada became quite wealthy. But he had some really serious personal tragedies to deal with, I think, which made him the man that he was.
So I guess the sickness was a big problem, right? A lot of children and people died.
Yes, the infant mortality rate was sky high. And in Manchester mid-century, it was 50% of children didn't make their first birthday. That's what it's like. And if you, when you do family history and the, you know, those in the States who look into, you know, have English heritage and ancestry and look into their, you know, past, they will notice that in any given, but obviously they're big families without contraception, but you will notice that in most families, you know, they will lose maybe 1, 2, 3 children out of 8 or 10, maybe even more sometimes. So that was very common. And my own family, you know, suffered multiple losses in the past. You know, I think my great grandparents, the ones that came from Italy, they had 10 children and only 4 survived. So that was the reality for most people.
After writing this and doing this book, how do you think it's changed you?
I think it's changed me completely, actually. I mean, it's very much it's brought me into the dark side. So I'm very much, you know, work as a crime historian now. It drew me into the underworld. It's changed my life immeasurably, really. I mean, I now work full time doing this, and I lecture and work as a part-time lecturer at Oxford Brookes University. So it's become very much, it's been very, very much my life. And it's also made me question things. It's made me think about more about life. It makes me question the news today more. It makes me look at, you know, it makes me try and look into things, you know, a bit more today, particularly anything to do with policing. I'm always making comparisons. But yeah, it has. It's taken me on a journey, I would say, which is beyond, perhaps it's gone beyond crime. Although I'm still focused on crime, but it's very much a study of human relationships and of you know, human conditions and existence. Really, I think crime is an interesting filter, so you can see all sorts of things about society.
So, do you find that you've changed the way you look at other people that you know or that you're around? Like, are you suspicious of everybody?
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? I guess my children would say probably yes. I'm always saying, "Oh, watch out for this, watch out for that." I think it's actually helped me perhaps not to judge people quite so. You know, ironically, it's probably helped me not to judge people quite so harshly. I think it's helped me, you know, in terms of contemporary life, to look behind the scenes a bit more, to look at what people might be struggling with. You know, maybe people who commit crime or do things that you perhaps wouldn't always approve of. So, in fact, I think it's. Try not to shout too much at TV programs.
Well, I think that, yeah, you know, and policing and TV, everything's kind of advanced a lot since then. But do you think policing has changed all that much outside of that?
Do you know, I don't think it has, because, you know, if you think about any contemporary kind of, say, for example, a homicide investigation, which is one of my special subjects, in fact, the police still work on instinct a lot, and often cases are solved out of luck, perhaps, rather than anything else. I mean, obviously, we have social media, and that makes a huge difference because you can post photographs. But in fact, and people, you know, people engage with the police more. But in fact, they used to do that in the past. So when a detective was investigating a case in the past, particularly, I mean, the Jack the Ripper murders are a case in point, they were inundated with contact from the public and general public, letters, people coming in, people having ideas. And much of policing is still based on eyewitness accounts, isn't it? Particularly, in the courts as well, when things get to court. Now, obviously, you don't have forensic. The forensics is different. But you can use forensics to put somebody in a place, in a specific location, but you can't always make that link to working out whether they actually committed the crime. So I don't think it's changed that much, to be honest.
Yeah, an eyewitness is always kind of questionable at times, right? Quite often it's not that good.
Oh, exactly. And that was the case, you know, certainly was the case in the Victorian times. And I noticed more in the Victorian investigations that they relied heavily on what people were wearing. So there's always a description of the suspect with the clothing. And in fact, that worked better in the past because people didn't have very many changes of clothes. So, in fact, often I've come across cases where the obvious perpetrators have covered up the blood on their trousers with paint because they didn't actually have anything else to wear. So, and of course, also what you wore denoted who you were in society. So if you were a labourer, you wore certain clothing. You know, if you were a gentleman or a woman, you know, you would wear certain clothing. And that's why the detectives used to disguise themselves, is because it was easy to dress as a butcher or a travelling salesman. So that was a useful, for them, that was a very useful kind of tool before they got to sort of looking at things like, you know, tattoos and hair and, you know, appearance, which, of course, you could change as well. So no, I think the witness accounts obviously were still questionable in the past, probably more so, but they were more detailed. They're always looking out for certain things.
Yeah, looking for. Did you come across a lot of female detectives back then, or was that just not heard of?
There were none officially. So there were no female police officers in the UK before 1915. And then there aren't really any female, I don't know actually, but there aren't any female detectives really till after the Second World War. So there were women who got involved in investigations, but only in a limited fashion. The women were, often they used the police officers' wives. They had a fairly pivotal role. So they used to sometimes act as decoys. So if they needed somebody to carry out a bit of an investigation who needed to be female, they usually used their wives rather than, you know, because there were no female police officers. And they also did the searching often in the police stations. If they brought in a female suspect, the women would do the searching, because there were plenty of female criminals.
Mm. Oh, of course. Yeah. So I just wonder, so when you talk about Jerome and stuff and his investigations and stuff, do you think there's any like him today?
I don't think you get the same characterization of police officers today as you did back then. I mean, obviously we all know about the Scotland Yard detectives. So we know about, you know, from TV, we know about Witcher, and we know about Charlie Field, who was the model for Charles Dickens, Inspector Bucket in Bleak House. And so they were very much celebrities then. And in fact, towards the end of the century, when Jerome Caminada was at the very height of his career, he was a household name. He was called Manchester's Sherlock Holmes at the time. Yet we don't really have that anymore. I think perhaps we had that a bit more in the late 20th century, with some of the big cases, certainly in England back then, if you think about, we would be pushed to name a detective, I think, whereas they were celebrities. They were reported in the press all the time. So when Caminada started to reach his kind of fame, all his cases were reported in the press. Whereas I think you would struggle if you did a press search now for a particular detective. I don't think you'd, even with the internet, I don't think you'd necessarily come up with as much, which is kind of strange, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Going back to female criminals, like Holmes with Irene, I believe Adler, Caminada became infatuated with a female criminal. Did they have a relationship, or how did that happen?
I don't think so. I mean, that's Alicia Ormond, who was a con artist, basically, and quite a sophisticated one. She would write out sort of fake promissory notes and deeds and then cash them in. He was charmed by her, because he certainly says that in his memoirs, but I don't think there's any evidence of any relationship as such. He did used to, the lines were very blurred back then, and he used to, you know, all police officers used to take somebody out for a drink. You know, it was very common practice to go and take somebody for a pint of ale, male and female, you know, if they were trying to get information or if they were a potential suspect. And so he certainly did that. But I don't think there's any evidence of any physical relationship. I mean, he was a very staunch Catholic, which I know doesn't mean everything. But I think he had a high moral stance. And of course, he could, you know, he might have been different privately. But I haven't found any evidence that he engaged in anything untoward with his female suspects or collaborators, because obviously sometimes they were informants. But he was very taken by her. His language that he uses in his memoirs to describe her, you know, is quite fanciful, and, you know, and he's obviously, she obviously was beautiful. Unfortunately, I never managed to find a photograph of her, but you never know, it might do one day.
You never know what turns up.
That'll be one of those moments where I stand up in the archives and shriek.
Yeah, yeah, they'll come arrest you. Make it too much noise. So at the end of the book, when someone buys the book and takes it home and reads it, is there something in particular you want them to get out of the book, or is there something you hope that they take away?
I hope that they'd enjoy on the sort of more superficial level. I hope they'd enjoy his exploits because he's very colourful. You know, he's quite unique. There's a lot of humour in his in the way that he dealt with people. There's quite a lot of funny stories. But at the same time, you know, I hope that people would be encouraged to think beyond that and to look at, you know, think about the social issues that Caminada was dealing with or that were, you know, were current at the time, the difficulties that people had to get by, the circumstances that people lived in. So I think that's what I would hope for, really.
Yeah, they still had the same problems. They had the pandemic, they had wars, they had racism, they had everything back then too, didn't they?
They did. And sometimes, you know, both ways is useful, isn't it? It's useful to look back at things. And sometimes it's useful to use the past to inform today, you know, inform us today. And sometimes, you know, when things come up in the news, you think, wow, you know, we're going backwards here. You know, this is what it was like in the 19th century. So, yeah, I think we do need to use the past to, you know, to inform ourselves better about the present and the future.
Yeah, I think we all too. Maybe we just don't educate the kids enough on a lot of the past. I'm not sure. People seem to forget.
They do, don't they? And people seem to look back at the past in rose-tinted glasses, and particularly, you know, the older generation, like perhaps my generation, or well, maybe, you know, it's easy to think that things were, you know, simpler back then and things were easier. But in fact, things have always been, you know, there have always been challenges, I think, for everybody. You only have to look in one Victorian newspaper, which is actually quite a fun activity, is to look at because there's all sorts of wild and wacky stories. But, you don't need to look very far to find the difficulties that people engaged with. I don't know about children. I mean, my children both studied history at school. In fact, my daughter's doing a degree in history. I mean, there's still, I would say, quite a lot of focus on the higher echelons of society, perhaps, and not so much, you know, on the ordinary people, which I think is starting to change. Lots of historians are working in this sphere. But yeah, it's going in the right direction. But I think that's what we need to do, is that we need to provide a rounded picture of the past.
Yeah, you're right. It wasn't all perfect and great in the good old days. we just sort of forget a lot of that, I think, you know, or don't know about it. I guess that would be the case there. So so what's up for you next? Like, what do you got going on after this book?
So I've done a couple more since, smaller books, but at the moment I'm doing a PhD, so I'm halfway through. So I'm looking at detective history, and basically this kind of spring, Caminada's springboarded me into this because I wanted to know, you know, how exactly the Victorian detectives developed their investigative skills. And I'm not focusing on Scotland Yard because all the research in the past has virtually been on Scotland Yard. So I'm doing it on Manchester, Liverpool and Birmingham. And I hope to be able to, you know, share some brand new research into exactly how they managed to piece everything together and how they did their investigative work. So I'm mostly doing that and doing some lecturing alongside. And then I have got some ideas for new book projects later in the year. Particularly want to look at victims, perhaps victims of crime. And look at, you know, that side. I've been very challenged to look at that side of the cases. So not the kind of gory bits and the gruesome bits, but also to think more deeply about the people, the other people, you know, in the story. But yeah, I've got to finish off this academic year first.
A lot of work. Do you have a website or a place that you have set up for people to come find out about your writing or book?
Yes, so I do have a website. It's called victorian-supersleuth.com. So that is, yeah, all my contact details. My books are all on there. And I have a regular sleuthing blog on there as well, where I post quite regularly new crime investigations. And there are all kinds of things. It's not so much related to Caminada, but all kinds of crime and things that I come across, particularly from my research. And I'm on Twitter as well as Victorian Sleuth. And have a Facebook page, and all the details are there on the website.
Well, we'll have that on our site as well, and we'll let so people can find you with one click, and if they're listening and things like that. So did the pandemic has it gotten in the way of your writing and your researching?
Well, yes, sadly, yes, because I haven't been able to go to any archives. I was quite fortunate that at the very beginning of 2020, I did a bit of a tour around, you know, Manchester and Liverpool and Birmingham, and collated lots and lots of information. So what you tend to do these days in the archives is you basically go in and you photograph about 1,000 images, and then you spend, you know, the next 3 months sifting through them. And I have fortunately done that. So that's carried me through for a while. And I've managed to go back to the National Archives, which, as I say, is in London. So it's literally just a 20-minute drive from here, 25-minute drive from here. So I have popped back. But I'm ready to go back full to the archives. I think they're all opening in May, basically. So I'll be back at the archives soon. And I hope to get back up north to some of the archives. I mean, hopefully, with our vaccination programme, we've been very lucky here in the UK now. So hopefully these will stay open so that we can it's, you know, get to the repeated trips is going to become quite necessary.
Yeah. Hey, I was just wondering, did you ever come across how was crime dealt with during the Spanish flu, like the first big pandemic? Matt, how did the police deal with crime and or did they?
Yeah, I don't know, to be honest. It's a very good question. I do know that during the wars, you know, during the First World War, because obviously that was at the same similar time, there were fewer murders. I mean, I think it would be interesting to find as well, you know, when we look back on this period and analyse crime, won't it? Because I think my feeling is the crime rate was probably lower. It's a bit beyond my period because I tend to stop at the First World War, but I haven't come across quite so much, you know. You also get a decline in crime as well at the beginning of the 20th century, partly because, I mean, the sort of crime that I'm dealing with, partly because conditions have improved. So in the cities like in Manchester, you know, there's got much better sanitation. And we don't have, you know, obviously there's no financial support as such for people beyond the, you know, the parish relief or the workhouse. But things do start to improve. Health starts to improve. And so the crime rate does decline. Policing, you know, improves as well. And I suspect that carries on. And then, of course, after the Second World War, we then start to get much more formal policing. You know, we get police training colleges, we get forensic labs, all those sorts of things. So I think probably the crime rate was arguably lower and the policing was better during that period. So it probably didn't have, you know, whether it had much to do with the Spanish flu. I mean, I guess in times of crisis like that, with a natural natural and national crisis, people's attention is largely focused other places. But then, of course, you also get tensions, don't you? And, of course, there was lots of crime following, certainly, the First World War. There was lots of crime specifically relating to the experience of individuals in that war. So serving officers, you know, who maybe have been gassed, that kind of thing. But I think they were more isolated cases.
Yeah. Well, I just, you know, wondering if there was a crime or with all of that trauma going on, I wonder just how much crime or how much they could deal with it, how much time they had, and if they were worried about being sick or what was going on, if they had anti-maskers out there, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I don't know. I mean, yeah. They probably just plowed on, to be honest.
Yeah. I don't know. It's just, it's interesting. It'd be kind of, there you go. I give you an idea for a new book.
Yeah.
Well, it's certainly been a pleasure. We're glad you came on the show, and we've been talking about the real Sherlock Holmes, and it's the hidden story. It's the hidden story of Jerome Caminada.
There we go.
And our guest has been the author Angela Buckley. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. No, it's been wonderful. Great to speak to you.
Thanks, Angela.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.